Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
Tonight with Romans chapter 7, and at verse 7, I believe, is our point of renewal. At this particular point in the chapter, Paul has brought out how that a person is subject to the law under which he lives. Of course, we today are subject to the law of Christ. The Jews, during the time of the Mosaic Law, were subject under that law. The Gentiles, before that, had been subject under certain moral laws. And Paul uses marriage as an illustration to show our amenability, our accountability to the law under which we live, by teaching that a woman is to be married, or is married to her husband, and she is bound to her husband as long as he lives. If she marries while her husband is still alive, she'll be called an adulteress. If the husband be dead, then she is free to marry and would not be called an adulteress. As we mentioned when we went through that, this is not the sum total. In fact, marriage is not even the primary theme of this chapter, but it certainly teaches truth about marriage. It shows God's will concerning marriage. It does not go into the exception of divorce being allowed because of fornication, which is the only allowed cause in the Bible for divorce. And the reason, no doubt, that it didn't go into the exception because marriage wasn't the subject. He was simply trying to teach here the necessity of being accountable or recognizing our accountability to the law under which we live. Having said that, he said we are delivered from the law. That's the old law of Moses. We serve under a different system. He characterized the old law as the oldest of the letter, and he characterized the new law of Christ as the newness of spirit. Then in verse 7, where we begin tonight, he raises this question. What shall we say then? What sort of conclusion can we draw from this? What lesson do we need to learn? Is the law sin? And then he says, God forbid, or literally, may it not be so. Now, inasmuch as we are freed from that law, was it because the law was bad? No, that wasn't the purpose, or that wasn't the explanation, and that wasn't the reason. The law was not evil. The law was not bad. The law had certain purposes that it was designed of God to accomplish, but there are some things that the law would not accomplish. But it was not sin. He said, nay, I had not known sin but by the law. For I had not known lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. Now, sin is described in 1 John 3 and verse 4 as a transgression of the law. Sin is abominable in the sight of God. But if God had not given his law telling us what is and is not sin, how would we know? How would we know when we would be offensive to God and when we would not be? Why, there had to be the revelation of God's law. And the law showed to us what sin is. The law of Moses showed just how sinful sin is. The law of Moses defined sin. The law of Moses condemned sin. However, the law is referred to in Hebrews 8 and verse 7 as being faulty. But it was not faulty because it was evil. It was faulty because it lacked something. It lacked the way of salvation. The law of Moses did not provide for the forgiveness of sins. That was only accomplished by the shed blood of Jesus Christ. So the law wasn't evil, even though it's been taken out of the way. Let's not look upon it as being something bad or something lacking within the purposes that God gave for it. It accomplished the things that God intended for it to accomplish. But there are some things. The law of Moses did accomplish what God wanted it to accomplish, but it did not accomplish the fulfillment of that promise that God gave to Abraham, that in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now I want you to notice something else here in verse 7 that is extremely important for us to see. He said in verse 6, we're delivered from the law. And he says, the law has said, thou shalt not covet. What part of the law of Moses included, thou shalt not covet? Anybody? The Ten Commandments. It's the tenth of the Ten Commandments. Now, sometimes people will tell you, if you live by the Ten Commandments, God will be pleased with you. You don't realize we are delivered from the Ten Commandments. Do you know that? Here we're delivered from the law, and the law said, thou shalt not covet. Therefore, I know that I'm delivered from the Ten Commandments, because thou shalt not covet one of the Ten Commandments. Seventh-day Adventists will come along and say, we're still bound by the Ten Commandments, and particularly the fourth, to remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. Well, we're not bound by the Ten Commandments, and here the Apostle Paul specifically states, he's one of the ten. We're not bound by those laws. We've been delivered from that. Now, that does not mean that it's all right now to covet. The Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not steal. The Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not commit adultery. That doesn't mean it's all right to do those things. They're still sin. But why are they still sin? Somebody? Beg pardon? What law of God does it transgress? It's the law of Christ that it transgresses, you see. And when you steal, you're not counted as sinful because you violated the Ten Commandments. You're counted as sinful because you violated the law of Christ. And this shows the one to whom we are accountable and responsible. But the law of Moses has been taken out of the way altogether, totally, completely, every part of it, including the Ten Commandments. And this, of course, is a very difficult thing for those of the Seventh-day Adventist persuasion to be able to overcome. In fact, they can't overcome it. But in verse 8, he said, but sin, taking occasion by the commandment, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence. Now, that's a big word for lust. For without the law, sin was dead. Now, if the law hadn't said, this is sinful, then sin wouldn't have been alive. But the law said, this is sinful, and then when you do that which the law says is sinful, then you're guilty of sin. Sin is very much alive. If there hadn't been a law against it, there wouldn't be any sin. But since there was a law against it, and you do those things, then you are guilty of sin. And you'll notice, but sin taking occasion by the commandment wrought in me, that is, it provoked me, it exposed me to sin. That's because the law told us what sin was. It's like, here's a curtain. Behind that curtain, you don't know what it is. But the law, let's say behind the curtain, is what God says is sin. How are you going to know what God says is sin? Why, you pull back the curtain and it's revealed to you. Now, that's what God did with the Mosaic Law. He pulled back the curtain and he said, now, this is sinful, that is sinful, that is sinful. And therefore, when you do those things that are sinful, why, you're guilty of violation of the law. He said, for I was alive without the law once, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. Now, I will ask the question. I want you to stop and think. When, in the life of Paul, was he ever alive without the law, the Mosaic Law? Anybody? When was he spiritually alive without the Mosaic Law? One way would when the gospel would be in effect, wouldn't it? Would there and could there have been any other time in his life when he was not responsible to that law? Right. When he was but an infant. One who is an infant is not responsible, nor accountable, nor even has the capacity to obey or disobey either one. Now, he said, and I think this must be surely before he became accountable. He was alive without the law once. That was back during his infancy, during his youth, during his time when he was not accountable, but there came a time when he was accountable, and he came to understand what the commandment was, and he obviously violated the commandment, and sin was very much alive, and therefore he was spiritually dead. And that's what the law of Moses would do for a fellow. It would say, here is sin, you have sinned, you are now condemned, therefore you are spiritually dead. Unfortunately, it didn't provide for the way to make you spiritually alive again. And there you see the great distinction between the law of Christ and the law of Moses. But he says in verse 10, where am I? I tell you, this new thing here has gotten me befuddled tonight. Or maybe it was that thing that did. Verse 10, I believe, isn't it? Where's that light? And the commandment which was ordained to life, I found to be unto death. You know that the law of Moses, if one had lived perfectly under it, remember that word perfectly, sinlessly perfect under it, why, one would not have needed forgiveness, would he? But that was an impossibility. Man cannot live sinlessly perfect. And the commandment was ordained to life to help man gain spiritual life in two ways. Even the law of Moses was directed towards spiritual life in two ways. One way, it was to bring us unto Christ, in whom there is life. And the other way was to inform people what sin is, that they might avoid it. Now, in that sense, the law of Moses was ordained unto life. But because it did not provide forgiveness of sins, it was also that which brought death. Because it condemned sin, one sins, therefore he's dead. Now, I want you to notice verse 11. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it slew me. I've got three words in that verse underlined that I think are highly significant. The first word is sin. The second one, deceived. The third one, slew. Now, folks, this shows us the power of sin. Sin can deceive. Sin can make it look like it's something worthwhile and beneficial and good and valuable, and all the while it's deadly and destructive. And people can be deceived. The pleasures of sin are deceitful. I don't know of anything that's much worse than a person being deceived. What does it mean to be deceived? Somebody, have you ever been deceived? Misled? Right? Led to believe something is so that's not so? You ever have anybody to deceive you? I'm not talking about just having to maybe give you some accidental false information, but deliberately misguide and deceive you. How do you feel about that? Do you look with confidence on that kind of character? Do you consider them trustworthy? One who would deliberately deceive you, lead you to believe, now this is so, and that's not so at all. Something else is so. Now that's what sin will do for you. Sin will say, oh, pleasure, oh, the power, oh, the fame, oh, the acceptance, oh, the abundance of the things of life, oh, the good life. But it's deceptive. And if we're deceived thereby, it will slay you spiritually. It'll bring about your spiritual death. And that means separation from God. That's a verse that shows the destructive power of sin. But now as for the law, in verse 12, wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just and good. The law of Moses is not therefore to be looked upon as something bad or evil or sinful. It was just simply inadequate to supply everything that God intended to supply. It was adequate for the purpose for which God gave it. But God did not give the law of Moses in order to that be the way of salvation for mankind. Then he raises verse 13. Was then that which is good made death unto me? Is that the end result? Is something good and then it turns out that it slays me? He says, God forbid. But sin, now sin is what brings about death. The law didn't bring about death. Sin is what brings about death. The law simply told you what sin is. But sin, that it might appear sin, that you'll know that it's sin, working death in me by that which is good, that sin by the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. The commandment simply tells us, this is sinful, this is terribly sinful, this is exceedingly sinful, this will destroy you. But the law doesn't bring about the death. The law warns you of what brings about death. What brings about our spiritual death? Sin does. The law is not what causes the problem. It's the violation of the law. Wages of sin, sin pays. You pay with spiritual death. Here you go down the highway, 25 miles on, but you're doing 50. There's smoking. Now, some of you are laughing. You must know exactly what I'm talking about. Somebody told me how this is. There's smoking. Well, now, did thus. They finally bring you forward the JP or whoever. $50 fine or whatever. Was it the law that made you pay that $50 fine? Or was it your violation of that law? Was it the speed limit that cost you $50? It was your violation of the speed limit. The law of Moses did not bring death. It warned of death. The law of Moses defined what will kill you, and that's sin. And therefore, in that sense, it was good, it was holy, it was just. It is not to be looked upon as something evil. All right? Now, in the next few verses, I believe the Apostle Paul expresses some thoughts here that every single one of us, we can really relate to it. I think we can really understand what he's talking about. Here is the battle that the Christian has. He said, For we know that the law is spiritual. That is, the law appeals to the spirit or to the mind of man. But I am carnal. I'm flesh. I'm a human being. Sold under sin. For, now here's the problem. For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that do I not. But what I hate, that I do. You ever find yourself in that sort of situation? Here's something that why you your principles would not allow it, and yet you find yourself doing it. You wouldn't allow it in others, but here you come along and you're doing it yourself. Here's something you know you ought to do, but you don't do it. Here's something you know you ought not do, and lo and behold, that's the very thing that you are doing. Why this conflict? Because there's a conflict between the mind and the body. Now, what he's driving toward here is that we must come to the point of spiritual maturity sufficiently to where the mind controls the body rather than letting the fleshly appetites of the body take dominance over the mind. But there's this struggle going on. There's this battle. Doing what you ought and living that way. Knowing what's right and doing what's right. Did you ever, now don't anybody ask out loud, did you ever do anything? You knew it wasn't right when you were doing it, but you did it anyhow. Now, that's right. Self-control. That's what he's talking about. That's the reason the gospel appeals so much to the heart or to the mind of man. The Lord knows if he can capture your heart, he'll more than likely control your behavior. But if he can't capture your heart, the carnality of mankind will control his behavior. Yes, the evil speech and so forth proceeds out of the heart. A wicked life, it first begins by thinking about it. Then he goes on to say, if then I do that which I would not, I consent unto the law that it is good. When I know I am doing something here that I ought not do, and it's because the law has already said, don't do it, I'm agreeing. The law's right. Now, I may not be conforming to the law, but the law is right. And the law is good. But then he says something that's rather puzzling at first. Now then, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. He's not saying, I'm not guilty of sin. He is saying, it's no longer my desire, nor my will, or my intent maybe to do certain things, but I do it anyway, and it's because sin has dominated me. Sin has captivated me. I have surrendered to sin. And you know, folks, we can have the very best intentions about things and then sometimes go opposite to those intentions. Okay. Now, we need to intend right. We need to have right motives, but we don't always live up to that. Verse 18, he says, for I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. I know what I ought to do, but now, always making myself do just what I ought to do. That's another matter, isn't it? Man of experience. Beg pardon? That's one of the main points he's bringing out. We are in a constant battle. The old devil will appeal to us through the body. And if we give in to the ways of the body, rather than letting the mind be saturated with the will of Christ and control the body, and let the will dominate the body rather than the body suppress the will, if we don't do that, we're going to find ourselves captivated in sin. It is so important, and I can remember hearing my parents sometimes say to me, boy, get a hold of yourself. I know what they meant. They didn't get your thinking straight. Where's your thinking? Get your head on right. You know you ought not do that. Oh, I remember one time so vivid. Well, I heard about this boy that did it anyway. One of the first times this boy ever got to take the car out by himself is to a football game. Went to a football game. We won. Of course, we were a little excited coming back. Another boy, a friend of mine, he had a Jeep, an old Army leftover Jeep. I had my daddy's old 36 Buick. That was the car at the time. Of course, it was up in the 40s. It was an old car, but that was our car. So we decided we'd out in Bellevue about 15, 20 miles, race you back. Now, I knew better, man. But I wasn't getting ready to let that Jeep beat that Buick. And man, we took off. I knew every turn. I knew every stoplight, every stop sign that STOP, slow. I knew every one of them was supposed to stop. I knew better than that. We was flying down. We went through an intersection just like something was after us. Here goes my Buick. He comes that Jeep. Right behind us. Here's a car sitting at that intersection. Somebody said, "You see that car?" I said, "Yeah." "Did you know that's your cousin Jimmy Hooper's car?" "What?" "My daddy went to the ball game with cousin Jimmy Hooper. You know that one, my cousin Jimmy Hooper's car." So we went on. I came in. He was sitting in the living room. I came in and gave him the keys. He just looked up at me. "If I ever see or even hear of you driving like that again, you'll never sit behind the steering wheel of a car I own as long as you live. Now get out." That's exactly what he said. I didn't even say hi, Dad. That's just, man, he laid that finger right there and he laid it right on me. He didn't have to tell me that twice. But now I know what it means to know what you ought to do. And I know what it means to do what he just didn't understand the pressure of that Jeep. And now, I've given my testimony and confessional, but that was way back in the dark ages. And I was way back in high school. Of course, I knew better, and you've done worse. You've done worse. Some of your friends have already told me about some of you, so I know you've done. No, not really. But now, that illustrates the point, doesn't it? Here's something you ought to do. I ought to contact that negligent member week after week after week after week. You hadn't done it yet. Now, you intend to. You've got good motives. You hadn't done it. And if you don't let the will control the mind, you won't do it for Sunday either. And now, if the will gets a hold of your mind, somebody's going to be contacted tomorrow. Okay. Here's somebody sick or in need. I know I'll do that. I know I ought to put this first. Well, that's the battle that the Christian always has. Now, he says, verse 19, "For the good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do. Now, if I do that, I would not, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me." He's repeated that. He said it in verse 17. He said it again in verse 20. It shows the power of sin. Folks, we just don't dare flirt with sin because it is more powerful than we are. It will deceive you and slay you. He says, "I find in a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. For I delight in the law of the Lord after the inward man, after the heart. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind." That's God's law in the mind. "Bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members." Paul recognized there was this conflict between the law of God and the law of the flesh. And if we realize it, well, we're going to be better able to fight it. And then he concludes in verse 24, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death?" How am I going to get free from all of this? How am I going to get relief from this tremendous, constant, lifelong struggle? Well, there's only one way. I thank God through Jesus Christ, our Lord. That's the only way that you can fight this battle successfully. "So then with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin." So we have to be aware of this constant conflict going on. And that's what the Christian life really is. You know, sometimes we may get just tired, discouraged. Just look like there's one knock right after another, one disappointment right after another, one sadness right after another, one problem right after another, one rebellion right after another, another disappointment right after another. They say, "I'll be so glad when we can quit all this struggle." Well, there's only really one way you're ever going to quit that struggle. That's when you lay down and die. Because the devil's not going to give you any peace. But we can whip him, not by ourselves. But we, like Paul, can thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. We can whip him with the Lord. This is one reason that it's so puzzling to me. It's just absolutely bewildering to me. I cannot fathom that when things go wrong, so many people, what's the first thing they quit? They quit the church. I just can't understand. The only source of strength that they have, the first thing they drop is the Lord. I just don't have an explanation for that. But that happens so many times. When people get offended or people get hurt or people do something, the problems come, the first thing they do is quit the church, quit worshiping God, turn their back on the only source of help that there is. Why, that's when we need the Lord more than ever before. And that's when we can turn to Him and count on Him. Every one of us, I think, can say, oh, wretched man that I am. Who's going to deliver me? Why, Christ is the deliverer. Now, this falls right into this great theme of Romans, the system of salvation. What's the way of salvation?